It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about the top internet memes of the year, the images and the concepts that went viral from the Harlem Shake to a fluffy dog sharing its inner thoughts and emotions.
But first, the wolf hunting and trapping season ended last week in Wisconsin, but some controversies are expected to continue into the new year, including a higher quota for the wolf harvest and the use of dogs as part of the wolf harvest. WPR reporter Chuck Quirnbach has been covering the wolf hunt. He joins us now. Chuck, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Let's start with the numbers. The quota for the wolf hunt this season was 251. That was more than double last year's number, as I understand it. Where did this bigger target, this larger quota, come from?
Well, there was a desire by the state and others to increase the quota because the last year's kill total, the 2012 kill total, was about 117, not enough to make much of a dent or if all of a dent in the state's estimated wolf population, which is 800 or so, 825. It's an estimate, of course. So the decision was made to boost the quota and raise it. And this year, the Native American tribes in the ceded territories chose not to sort of lay claim to any. They didn't shoot any last year, but they this year just sort of decided not to even lay claim to any. And so the increase in the quota went up quite a bit.
Now, as I recall, the quota for this year, as I mentioned, was 251. And it seems as though at least the first part of that wolf hunt, those quotas around the state, there were different zones, and the quotas were being met relatively quickly.
Well, it's true. And there are six zones for the wolf hunting season and that started October 15th. And in five of those, things did proceed quite quickly, although some of us were looking closely at the numbers and noticed that Zone 3, this area stretching from Burnett County, sort of winding east over towards the Wisconsin River, in other words, Grantsburg over to near Merrill, was falling quite behind pace, if you will, well short of what the quota was. And the DNR said that while they had quadrupled the quota in that zone because it's an area sort of at the edge between farms and forest, and they wanted, and there'd been a lot of animal depredation, livestock killing by wolves in that area, and they wanted to make sure there was a higher quota for the wolves there. And, you know, gun and trappers took some, but not enough to prevent the use of dogs in the hunt, which started back on December 2nd.
And as soon as you mentioned dogs, that was a very big controversy this year. The first time legal use of dogs in the wolf hunt. Can you give us a little bit of background on how the dogs wound up being included in the hunting regulations and maybe present both sides of the argument?
Well, of course, it was proposed first and it was included in the law that passed in 2012. Various groups objected to the use of dogs in the and succeeded in keeping dogs out of the first wolf hunt, plus the quota, the lower quota was reached pretty early on in 2012. So between the courts and what happened in the fields and forests, if you will, dogs were not used in 2012, even though, you know, it was proposed by various folks, including trappers, hunters, bear hunters that wanted to make use of their dogs in the wolf hunt. Didn't happen in 2012. This year it did, just in Zone 3, as we say, was fiercely opposed still because the lawsuit that helped block the use of dogs in 2012 is still active. It's now basically the use of dogs was okayed early this year, but now then it got appealed to the state appeals court and sitting in the appeals court waiting for some final decision on it. But since there was no final decision, the use of dogs was allowed to go ahead after the gun deer season ended, in other words, about December 2nd.
Now, as part of that controversy, we heard lots of fears that dogs and wolves would wind up, you know, fighting as part of all this, then there'd be all sorts of blood, and it would just not be something that that proponents of the opponents, I should say, of dogs being used wanted to see. Did we have any reports that there were any issues like that that occurred?
Well, there were various reports, mainly from animal protection and education groups, suggesting that pictures being posted on social media by some of the hunters showed wolves very bloody, not just maybe from gunshot wounds, but from dogs getting at them. But so far, I don't know of any reports of the DNR really ticketing anyone, any wardens ticketing anyone for violating the... Right now, dogs are only supposed to track and chase wolves, not engage with them, not fight with them, not having them chew on each other, if you will. That's supposedly illegal. Right now, we don't have any documented cases, according to the DNR, of that going, of the illegal behavior going on. But there's this thing where the hunters that used dogs don't have to bring in the wolf carcasses until the 5th of the month after all this happened, in other words, January 5th. So there's been a lot of wolf carcasses that haven't been examined yet, and there's going to be a question of how, who's going to examine them, how closely they will be examined. Will they be examined just for biological information about the wolves, or will they be looked at in a way to see if there was any lawbreaking going on?
Now, as we look ahead to next year, assuming that the wolf hunt goes ahead, taking a look at this year into account and all of those sorts of things, are there some changes that may occur in terms of either the quota or the methods used in the wolf hunt?
Well, a lot depends on what happens and with upcoming population estimates, you know, wolves having pups and so on in the late winter and into the spring, and how well the pups survive and how many survive. If the overall population estimate remains around 800, then there will be pressure to keep that 250 or so as the quota if the population has dropped off dramatically. And whether, you know, there are other factors, of course, like winter, a harsh winter, a roadkill, and other things like that that factor in. The debate will be whether to stay at 250, you know, cut it back, increase it. The DNR has said it's flexible. But right now, it's a little too early to say exactly what's going to happen. And then there's this issue of the court looking at the use of dogs, whether the dog use will remain part of the wolf hunt.
But for sure, it sounds as though it's a story that we'll be hearing more about.
Oh, yeah, and we've, you know, there's some debate as to, uncertainty as to whether the DNR will update its wolf management plan. That's sort of been the framework for all this, whether that will be done by next year, or there's been some reports at one of the Wolf Advisory Committees that things might not be done until early 2015, and there wouldn't be a new management plan until 2015, meaning the 2014 hunt, wolf hunt, could look a lot like it did this year, again with the dog being the wild card issue.
All right, Chuck, well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was WPR reporter Chuck Quirnbach. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Since it's the end of the year, we're taking a look back, and now we're looking at the best the internet had to offer in 2013 in the form of memes.
Dictionary.com defines a meme as a cultural item in the form of an image, a video, or a phrase that is spread via the internet and often altered in a creative or humorous way.
We have an expert here to give us some of the top viral trends of the year. He is Brad Kim, editor of Know Your Meme. Brad, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Good to be on the phone. Thank you.
So I've seen the numbers. The top meme of 2013 was, and we'll talk about the pronunciation of this, Doge or Doge. Well, first of all, what is that meme?
Okay, so Doge or Doge. It's basically a misspelling of a dog with a soft G or a hard G, basically it's a series of photographs of a Shiba Inu dog. It's a Japanese breed of a dog with the pointy ears and orange fur.
And he's a fluffy fella.
Yes, the puffy one. And it's pictures of a Shiba Inu doing various things, they're. The key feature is that they're captioned with very like silly internal monologues from the perspective of the dog, and they're written in usually in broken English and written in Comic Sans font, which is kind of the go-to font for sarcasm or tongue-in-cheek kind of humor, and it's one of those things they're much better shown than told, but. One of the most popular examples is this, animated GIF of a Shiba Inu dog, like, tapping on bongo drums, and the captions say, wow, such skill, much accomplishment, or, you know, very endurance, so proud. It's kind of, you know, grammatically awkward, you know, kind of exclamations, and, you know, it's supposed to be, you know, this character that's very adorable and dumb because, you know, the character is so easily impressed by everything, and, you know, he tries to use interesting words, but, you know, they're never quite right in the right tense or proper tense. So, yeah, it's one of those, you know, silly memes that, you know, won't take too long for anyone to get, and it's a chuckle-worthy meme, I would say.
And when I first heard about it, I thought it was kind of the answer to the LOL cats, the picture of the cat with the funny, you know, ICANN has cheeseburger types of things.
Yes.
But it's a little different, too, that whole stream of consciousness thing it has going.
Right, right, right. It's a slightly different character than, you know, its lolcat counterpart. But yes, like you said, it's definitely an emerging trend of you know, the so-called lolspeak, you know, which has been traditionally a territory of cats for many years. But it is definitely that kind of humor catching up with dogs.
So.
I guess the main difference is that, you know, I guess the biggest, most obvious one being, you know, it really uses Comic Sans font to its maximum lol value, if you will.
So before we move on to other memes, Brad, I want to ask, and a lot of people probably who look at these things or hear about them and are thinking, what the heck? Where do these things emerge? Who comes up with them, and how do they come to the attention of the greater internet public?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, with Doge, it's interesting because, you know, the earliest known mention of, you know, the word Doge in referring to a dog comes from a very, very old episode of this popular web flash animation series called Homestar Runner. And it comes from an episode that was released in 2005, where one of the main characters refers to his sidekick as a doge with an e at the end. And but you know, the meme, the character of the Shiba Inu as Doge, it actually, you know, blew up on the internet fairly recently on Tumblr after the name became associated with Shiba Inus, which, you know, alternatively referred to as Shiba. That's another nickname for the dog, is Shiba. And, yeah, so it the character itself originates from Tumblr.
Hmm. And what does it take, though? Like, why does one thing hit critical mass, and I assume there are zillions of other things that people are trying to create as memes that don't come to the public attention like that?
Right. I think, you know, one of the factors, you know, that the key factors that, you know, made Doge such a popular meme is that, you know, like we were saying before, this sort of, broken English grammar, like things that are said from the perspective of an animal, it has really, you know, been a cat thing, predominantly cat thing. And I think what we're seeing is, you know, people trying to kind of, you know, take an existing trope or a theme, and really just trying to expand it into other, you know, other species and other realms. So yeah, in a way, it's kind of an evolved iteration of an ongoing theme.
And it is a cute dog. I want to move on to another meme, though. A word this time that took off, kind of a made-up word or a compound made-up word, cringeworthy, is one that had been around for a while, I gather, but took off. First of all, what is cringeworthy?
So cringeworthy is, it's actually a pretty, common English adjective that describes, you know, any thing that evokes the feeling of embarrassment on the part of the observer. So, you know, in the context of the internet, it would be something cringeworthy would be any sort of, you know, social media, meaning, a status update, video, or a photo, you know, that makes the viewer go, oh my God, I can't finish, you know, this. I can't, keep watching this. It's kind of like a train wreck. But it's, It's also worth mentioning that it's kind of an evolved form of fail humor, which has been, you know, a pretty popular genre of internet humor for years. You know, it's somebody does something wrong and, you know, everyone laughs. But with cringeworthy, you know, pictures and videos, they're slightly different because it's hard to flat out laugh at these failures because usually they tend to hit a little bit too close to home. So, for example, when you see a picture of your friend, you know, who's got a new brand new tattoo of a, you know, of a meaningful quote, let's say, and you immediately spot a spelling error in it. Now that's, you know, something where you can't really flat out laugh at because, you know, it could, it's one of your best buddies, but, you know, it's still something, you know, that's hard to look at.
Well, from a word to a video, I want to play a little sample here. The Harlem Shake videos that were going around. Here's the song. And so the visual here, when they started, people were just kind of sitting around. One person, I think, doing a wacky dance. Everyone else sitting. And then when the beat kicked in there, everybody in the background would have a costume on, and they'd be jumping around and dancing. And lots and lots of people online were recreating this video. Where did it come from in the first place?
Well, the dance meme itself, well, there's a two-part to it. The song in itself is this electronic dance track made by an artist named Bauer in 2012. But the dance video meme itself came from this popular YouTube blogger. His name is Filthy Frank. And, yeah, he made this video with a couple of his friends, and they were all dressed in this, you know, colorful latex suits. They kind of, you know, started this dance video where, you know, they're dancing in a very chaotic way, you know, wearing something really goofy. And, but the viral instance is actually another one that, you know, that came after by this group of teenagers. You know, they were hanging at a friend's house, and, you know, like you said, you know, it begins with one guy just kind of, you know, shyly dancing while everyone else is just kind of chilling. And then, you know, yeah, the bass drop and everyone goes nuts. And, yeah, it took off in early February, and this Harlem Shake is kind of unprecedented in terms of scale because according to YouTube's analysis, within the first 2 weeks, there were about 40,000 videos that were uploaded, and you know, with totaling views of like almost 200 million views. So it really exploded onto the scene, and you know, the timing was interesting because you know it also kind of came off the heels of you know, Gangnam Style in the previous year, you know, hitting the 1 billion views mark. So I think it was you know. It was the you know the next. It was introduced as the next Gangnam Style meme with a lot more of a solid formula. You know, it has a very very easy to you know replicate formula and a routine to it. So you know it actually had a lot of holding with web companies. You know, like companies like BuzzFeed, and yeah, these it had a lot of support from you know people at work. And there were lots of office, you know, videos that are based around Harlem Shake. But yeah, it was definitely one of the biggest dance memes to emerge on YouTube ever.
And people out there are making their own, which is a really interesting thing, getting creative. We just have a minute or so left, Brad. Is there a sure. favorite meme of yours, either from this year or just emerging now maybe, that you're keeping an eye on?
Sure. It's I guess you know something that I think will be you know continue to grow into next year is live tweeting, and you know live tweeting is just something when you know when you're it could mean that you know you're tweeting about an event in real time, but you know specifically kind of it's you know overheard conversations that are tweeted in real time from a third party observer. So I think one of the bigger ones recently, even though it actually turned out to be a hoax, was this ABC producer who was on a you know on a flight to LA on Thanksgiving Day, and you know he you know, he started tweeting about this lady that was, you know, on the same plane, you know, that was giving the you know, attendants a lot of trouble. And so this sort of kind of eavesdropping on, you know, interesting gossipy, you know, conversations and just tweeting to the world about it, you know, it has its appeal.
Okay, Brad, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, no problem. Yes.
That was Brad Kim, editor of Know Your Meme. We've got one of those doges up on the Central Time Facebook page, by the way. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Experts say if you're looking to buy a new car, now is the time to get the best deals.
A lot of buyers will be expected to try to find some reduced prices as dealerships try to clear their lots for the new 2014 models.
Well, with all that going on, we thought it would be a good idea to get an expert in to give you some advice on what to look for when you're buying a new car and to answer any questions you might have. He is Paul Eisenstein, publisher and editor of thedetroitbureau.com. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, good to be with you.
Well, let's start with kind of what we saw happen in 2013. 2013 was predicted to be a pretty good year for the auto industry, and from what I've been able to garner, it sure looks like it was. Or is, I should say.
Yeah, it is. The year is racing to an end, but to the point of the subject today, manufacturers are hoping to squeeze out as many sales as they can before the ball drops on Times Square tomorrow.
So, and why is this so important, the end of the year, and why do they, you know, why does it matter if they get a couple more sales before the year ends?
Well, you could argue that it really doesn't. I mean, the fact is they're going to end the year with around 15.5 million sales, about a million units more than in 2012, significantly better than most anybody predicted going into the year, and the best that we have seen of the industry since the recession began. That said, manufacturers, well, it's like a dog, you know, you put puppy chow out, they're going to continue to eat until they can't, they literally run out of food. And the industry just likes to clock as many sales as they can, in part for bragging rights. You ask any executive and they say, oh, we don't care about being number one. Baloney. If next year that manufacturer has a chance of being number one in its segment, you're going to be hearing a lot about being number one.
America's number one pickup, America's number one small car, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
So what kind of trends did we see in 2013? What was selling well?
Well, this is an interesting year because there were some trends that nobody expected. Yes, we saw a continuing rise of small cars. Yes, we saw mid-size cars doing reasonably well. They were the hot vehicle in 2012. What really surprised everybody was the comeback of the full-size pickup truck. If anything, that's probably something we should be happy about. Oh, yes, I know that some people who hate the idea of these big gas-guzzling F-150s and Silverados running around because of how much fuel they consume, but the reality is they say that the economy is getting going again. The vast majority of people who buy these trucks today, as opposed to, you know, a decade or so ago when there were a lot of them sold to urban cowboys, today they're likely to be contractors or people who need them, whether to tow a boat or to do some work. And that means people are getting back to work.
And so we can take more away from that. I mean, this is really something you can look at and say it's a great sign for the economy that more of these full-size trucks are heading out the door.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a very good sign that the industry is recovering because the economy is recovering. And that, by the way, is something that we should point out. We'll see a lot of incentives at the end of the year. We'll probably see some good ones in the beginning of the year, rebates, low-interest loans, cheap leases, and the like. But the industry has actually tried to maintain a discipline that we hadn't seen over the years leading up to the crash of the market and crash of the economy. And we had such overcapacity in the middle of the last decade, going right through to when GM and Chrysler went bankrupt, that makers were just pouring out incentives. I mean, some of the deals you got were crazy. You'll see some of those now. It's typical for the end of the year and into January, because these are normally slow selling times, and manufacturers want to keep the factories going. But the reality is that they're doing a better job of matching production to demand.
And any thoughts on American versus imported manufacturers in the last year?
I'm sorry, say that one more time. For some reason, the phone broke up.
Yeah, sure. How did American manufacturers do compared to imports?
This has been an interesting year for the domestic makers. They seem to be gaining a bit more momentum, though it's not a free ride by any means. GM has been taking just award after award. They have three of the six models that are up for North American Car and Truck of the Year. You have the Chevy Impala, which was named the best sedan that Consumer Reports, often accused of being too import-friendly, the best sedan they've ever tested. The Corvette, the new Cadillac CTS, the Impala, on and on, have been winning award after award. Haven't gained as much as a lot of people would expect, considering how good the new products are, which, by the way, is matched by the fact that GM has been gaining ground in quality and reliability. It was the number one manufacturer in J.D. Power's initial quality survey, something that, again, the imports, primarily the Japanese, have dominated for decades. Ford has had some problems. They have had quality issues, some of it doing to do with their electronic technology, some of it to do with things like transmissions. Not that they break, they're just a little bit clunky. But they are doing well. They, in fact, today put out a release noting that they will be, for 2013, the Ford brand will be the number one brand in the United States. And Chrysler has done surprisingly well. They have some very strong product out there. Not all. Some of their products are struggling a bit, but they have gained ground, and again, they've been winning awards. Their Ram 1500 diesel was the pick for Motor Trend Truck of the Year just a couple months ago.
And that's a pretty amazing story in itself, considering where Chrysler was just a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When you consider that the plan was that they were going to go bankrupt. The government was going to save GM, but let Chrysler go bankrupt unless they had somebody come along to rescue them. And the White Knight, of all things, turned out to be Fiat. Well, here's the more amazing thing. Fiat is having its own problems right now because, as you may know, Europe is in the sort of hole that we were a few years ago. And, of all things, Chrysler right now is helping prop up Fiat.
Amazing. Well, it sounds like a good time if somebody is thinking about buying a car. It sounds like, next couple of days, kind of aside, this is still a pretty good time to be around. Sounds like there's a lot of good things to choose from. How do you convince a consumer right now that this is actually the time to buy?
Well, I'll tell you what, if anybody listening is interested in buying, let's say in the next month or so, I would seriously consider, if you can, trying to get over to the dealer quickly. If you know what you're looking for, I would probably call right away to see what sort of deal you might be able to get. I'd look online at places like KellyBlueBook.com or TrueCar.com. The Detroit Bureau, my site, of course, you'll find a lot of reviews and news and information. These folks, TrueCar, I consider one of the better ones for getting real pricing that'll tell you what's going on out there. And you may find that your local dealer will have an end-of-the-year sale that might not even show up online. There's a lot of those out there, and in some cases they will extend at least into a few days or maybe a week or so into 2014. But in some cases we may be running out on those deals very, very quickly. Now, that said, I should point out that there are particular market segments that are stronger in terms of the consumer than others. There are some segments I think you're going to find it harder to get a deal. Here's one that I think might surprise some people. There are tremendous deals out there for luxury cars, particularly, believe it or not, BMW and Mercedes.
Tell me more.
Well, it turns out that those two makers are slamming heads and desperate to try to win. Remember we said earlier, some makers just like to be able to have bragging rights. And the fact is that both those makers want to be the number one luxury brand in the United States, and they want to make sure that they knock Lexus, which had been for a while, back into the sand with no chance of coming close. So you're seeing some tremendous deals from BMW and from Mercedes. Lexus is trying to catch up, so they're offering some good deals, and so is Audi, which, curiously enough, is the number two luxury brand worldwide. But it has been still struggling to try to get into the first tier here in the United States. They never fully recovered from that that little safety scare that they had, oh gosh, back in the late 80s and early 90s, which
the
turned
unintended
out not to be the problems.
Yeah, the unintended acceleration. Yeah, I remember that.
Right. So, yeah, which turned out not to be their problem, but they're still struggling in the U.S. while they, by the way, Audi just, sorry to cut your question off, but Audi just announced they're going to spend $30 billion worldwide to expand production, add a huge number of plants, models, all aimed at becoming the world's largest luxury maker by the end of the decade.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking with Paul Eisenstein. He is the publisher and editor of the DetroitBureau.com about what to look for when you're buying a new car.
We'll pick up the conversation in a few moments, and we want to hear from you. Are you looking to buy a new car soon? What do you think are important things to keep in mind when car shopping? Or do you want to ask what the important things are to keep in mind? Would you recommend the make or model of car you have now? Why or why not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or if you're in the industry, we'd love to hear from you as well. 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're picking up our discussion now on what to keep in mind when you're buying a new car. Experts say now is the time to get the best deal on a new car. And we've got Paul Eisenstein, publisher and editor of the DetroitBureau.com. And he's here with some car buying advice.
And we want to hear from you. Do you want some advice on buying a car? Are you in the market for one or thinking about it and trying to decide if now is the right time? Question about a particular make and model of a car? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
Paul Eisenstein, before the break, we were talking about luxury cars and some of the opportunities there. Let's turn that question around, if we could. What categories are we going to have trouble finding a car in or getting a deal on this time of the year?
Well, some of the hotter products are going to be tougher to get a deal on. So it depends on where you are in fact. In some cases, it'll depend on what market you're in. And what particular vehicle you're going for and whether you're willing to settle for what's on the lot versus finding something that may be a little bit more customized to your liking. The interesting thing is you're going to probably get a good deal on almost anything right now. Some of the stronger selling vehicles may be a little less in the bargain category. So I'm not sure you're going to be getting the best deals on some mid-size models like the Toyota Camry, which is expected to end the year as the best-selling passenger car in America. Honda's selling out on the Accord, but they're advertising, as you've probably seen if you watch TV. You know, Honda has the Michael Bolton ads talking about their Honda deals. I think right now almost anything will get you a deal, at least in the next few days. But the more popular the vehicle, the more difficult it will be to continue getting deals, particularly after the end of the year rush.
And just on how does the internet and just that ability of people to search out prices, search out specific cars, how has that changed the world of dealers and how has it made their job different?
Oh, it's made it in some ways more difficult because in the old days, you could probably plant anybody in a dealer showroom that had a little bit of a, as we say, a schmoozing skill, somebody who could just talk your ear off. But these days, they can't just ramble on. They better darn well know what the car is all about, and they better know not just the specifics of that model, but they better know a lot about the competition. Because as many dealers have told me, the folks walking into the showroom today are likely to know more than the typical salesperson. They've done their homework online. Not only do they know what the horsepower numbers are, how many cup holders there are, what the fuel economy is, what options are available, and so on, but they're very likely to also know if they go in for a Camry, they may know everything about the Honda or the Ford Fusion or so on. And this makes it much more difficult for a salesperson to win you over, especially if they don't have the facts at their fingertip.
We've got some listeners who would like to join with some questions, and let's begin in Milwaukee. And Ken is with us. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
And what's your question?
I'm considering buying a Subaru Forester. this a good time to buy one?
Yeah. Now, the Subaru is a brand that has really taken off in the last few years. As a matter of fact, Subaru was the only brand to make it through every year of the recession by gaining sales and market share. It's rather phenomenal how well they've done. They used to be a bargain brand, somebody that you could almost always walk in and expect to get a deal. It's going to be a little bit tougher these days. You've got a new Forester out there, which has done very well in terms of ratings and reviews. And, again, you may be able to get some good bargains now at the end of the year. But I think you're going to find that the Subaru products are harder to get a bargain on than you may have expected a few years ago.
So what do you attribute their success to? Is it just good advertising? Have they upped the game on their product line?
I think they've really upped their game. Now, they've added a few new models, but they've really recognized that they need to be more than just a niche product. Subaru has been funny for a long time in that they have always been able to target a particular niche. They went all-wheel drive before all-wheel drive became hip. They went after unique market niches before those became something that, you know, in this internet world, we now know that makers will isolate specific groups of buyers and target them either through mass marketing or social media. For one thing, the Subaru brand was one of the first to openly acknowledge that there are gays out there and actually marketed to gays and to nurses and to rugged outdoor people, and that was very effective. They've also really improved a lot of the weaknesses in their products. So they tended to have a very cheap, plasticky feel to their interiors. If you get into a Subaru now, you'll find that they feel much more lavish and well-equipped.
Let's go to Brian, and Brian is with us from Kewaskum. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Hey, I do about 100 miles a day driving, and I've been in the market for a newer vehicle. And I've been looking at the Chevy Cruze diesel. What can you tell me about that?
Well, I'll tell you this. When people ask me whether they should go with a diesel or a hybrid or any other high-mileage product, I always recommend that they look at what type of driving they do. If you are driving a lot of miles in the city, and I do emphasize a lot of miles, and it's more stop-and-go traffic, you're probably going to do better off with a hybrid in, again, the city where you may not really need that much performance. If you're driving the type of distance you're talking about, which sounds like you may be putting on miles on the highway, diesels start to really sing. The fuel prices are high, so you lose a little bit of the advantage. But another advantage they have over a hybrid is that the performance of a diesel is that much better. Hybrids, by and large, with a few exceptions, tend to be rather sluggish. Diesels tend to be rather sporty. In some cases, they have better performance than the comparable gasoline vehicles. I like the Chevy Cruze diesel, and I applaud GM for being the first of the domestic makers to come out with a diesel. In fact, and I'm talking, of course, in passenger car side, in fact, we have no diesels yet from the Japanese in the passenger car market. We keep waiting for Mazda to bring out their version in the Mazda 6, but they've pushed it back till next spring.
So is America ready for a diesel? You know, I just remember all those old Mercedes diesels and, you know, GM's fiasco back in the 80s.
Things
have changed. I know that. But is America ready?
Well, here's the thing. If you go over to Europe and get into a diesel there, you'll find that you may not even realize you're in a diesel. It happened to me one time on a BMW preview I attended. I got into the diesel model by mistake, not the American engine, and it took me about 5-10 minutes until I came to a couple lights and the car was still a little cold, that I finally noticed, wait a second, am I in a diesel? And it was just barely discernible for somebody who's an expert in the field. The fact is, today's diesels are smooth, quiet, clean, quick. They have all the advantages that were their disadvantages in the past. That's why if you look in the luxury segment, you're seeing a flood of new models. Audi has just brought out 3 new diesels for 2014, and will bring out yet another one in a few months' time.
Let's go to the calls again, and Jen is with us, it looks like, from Ottawa, Minnesota.
Yeah, I was just sitting here rummaging through my glove compartment. Unfortunately, I'm driving, so I'm going to stop this. But I was trying to find the paperwork with the maker or the dealer that we dealt with on our new Toyota or our used new for us Toyota Tundra. I figured this was a good time to do a plug for them. They were such a great dealer to work with. I'm in Minnesota, and we spend months searching online and doing our homework. I have horses, and I've had GMC Sierra and the Chevy and Dodge Ram and a Mazda pickups throughout my lifetime, and this time we went with the Toyota Tundra. I tried to buy locally, but unfortunately, the price that we got on a Tennessee vehicle was $5,000 less. And so my husband he happened to have some clients out in that area, and so he made it a business trip and drove my truck home for me and ran him about $1,000 in gas, so we still had a nice savings.
That sounds good. And the Toyota Tundra, of course, the big Toyota pickup. And Jen also mentioned the used car market there, that they bought this one used. What's used cars look like these days? A year or two ago, the prices were way up, but I think they might be getting better now.
Yeah, used prices have been astronomical lately, and they vary month to month to month. I mean, I try to report on the used car market every month or two, and it depending on what day of the week I do and whose report I pick up on, prices can be up, can be down, can be up, can be down. And you really have to be very careful when you're in the used car market. You also have to be very careful about where you buy it. Make sure, always get a Carfax or one of the other checks that you can be sure about, you know, what the history of the vehicle is. Unfortunately, in many states, they make it very easy for the unscrupulous dealers and individuals to wash the title. In other words, if it was wrecked and rebuilt, or if it's been flood damaged or the like, in many cases, it can be difficult to find that out. So you really have to do your homework. Now, I will say that Tundra is not a bad pickup truck. But there's a reason why it is the only vehicle that Toyota has never had any come even close to catching the domestic manufacturers. The fact that Ram has won every award this last year, and the Silverado has a very good shot at winning North American Truck of the Year in just a few weeks, says a lot. Ford is going to have probably the biggest preview at the Detroit Auto Show, which is an international show despite being in Detroit, when they bring out an all-new F-150. I just don't think that the latest model, the update of the Toyota Tundra that they just brought out, is anywhere near as good as the domestic makers. And frankly, even some of the Toyota people admit that they're treading water, waiting until they can do yet another more dramatic redesign of the vehicle in a few years.
All right. Well, Paul, we're out of time, but thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you. Happy holiday to you and all the listeners.
Yep, I got to leave early and go make a deal on a new car. That was Paul Eisenstein. He's publisher and editor of thedetroitbureau.com. Coming up, we'll be talking to a guest who says we should stop arguing about the merits of lecturing and figure out instead how to best teach skills. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.